Today on Changing Course, we're talking with Chuck Malin, Bruce Chair of English and Cinema Studies here at the University of Tennessee. He's working on a new project that I'm very excited about. He seems excited about it. It's called The Complete Film Criticism, Reviews, Essays, and Manuscripts of James Agee as part of a series here by UT Press. Is that all correct?
That's all correct, Todd, yeah. And let me tell you, too, thanks for inviting me. It's such a pleasure to talk with you. We studied film together back in the 80s, and I followed your music career, too. And so it's always fun to get a chance to talk with you.
Why were you interested in this particular project?
Yeah, you know, I've been, I think being in Knoxville all these years, James Agee is one of our favorite sons, you know. And UT Press made a commitment back in the early 2000s to publish everything that Agee wrote. And Mike LaFaro, who's one of the general editors of that series, when they got it approved, he asked me if I would do the volume on Agee's film criticism and reviews. And I knew of Agee's film reviewing from a book called Agee on Film that was published back in 1958. I had a copy of it when I was studying film back in the late 60s and early 70s. And I always admired Agee's film criticism. So I told Mike, yeah, I would be happy to do that. And also, it gave me a chance to research a little more and find out a little bit more about Agee as a movie reviewer. And I love to do research on movies and research on films, so it gave me the opportunity to do that and do about a 50-page introduction to the book, too. So I thought it was a nice challenge, and no volume had tried to get everything that Agee published on film. Now, this volume isn't about his screenplays. There's actually going to be two separate volumes on screenplays, one of which has come out already, edited by Jeffrey Couchman. And it's a volume on Agee's screenplays for The African Queen and Night of the Hunter, two films that I think a lot of your listeners will know. That volume just came out a couple months ago. And my volume on the film criticism is going to be out, I think, sometime in July or maybe early August.
What was the period where he was writing film reviews, and why was he writing film reviews?
Yeah, you know, he loved movies from a very early age. If you remember in A Death in the Family, which is, you know, fairly autobiographical novel, early in the novel, Rufus and his father go from their house in Fort Sanders down to downtown Knoxville and go to the movies. And they see a Charlie Chaplin short and a William S. Hart Western. So, you know, from the time Agee was five or six, he enjoyed movies. And I was able to discover that his first published movie review was in 1925 when he was just 17 years old, and he did a review of F.W. Murnau's The Last Laugh, which is sort of famous German expressionist film. So he was interested in movies really from very early. When he got done with Harvard in the early 1930s, he was able to secure a job with Fortune magazine, which was owned by Henry Luce. And there he wrote essays on all kinds of things, like orchids of all things. And he also was given a task in the middle 1930s to go down to Alabama and live with a family of white sharecroppers, kind of see what their lives were like. And he was supposed to write an essay about white sharecroppers. Walker Evans went with him, the famous photographer, and took, you know, got a lot of images of the experiences they had there. And Agee quickly found out that he wasn't going to be able to write a single essay on that. So he actually took a long leave from Fortune and wrote that book, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. It came out in 1941 and got positive critical reviews, but it sold next to no copies. By 1941, people weren't so interested in problems of the Depression as they were about the World War that had begun in 1939. So Agee had to find a way to make a living after he finished that book. And Time magazine, also owned by Luce, offered him a job to write book reviews. And he really wanted to be a movie reviewer, but that wasn't open at the time. So in 1941, he started doing book reviews, And Paul Ashdown's volume in The Complete Works includes all of the many interesting book reviews and also other articles that he wrote, non-movie reviews and articles that he wrote for Time magazine. But finally, in September of 1942, he got the offer to do some movie reviews. So I think his first review was in September of 1942 for Time. And for most of that time then, between then and the end of the summer of 1948 and into the fall, he was a reviewer, a salaried movie reviewer for Time. In late 1942, in December of 1942, The Nation magazine, which was a narrower audience, more intellectual, more politically left magazine, asked A.G. if he would like to do a movie column. And he agreed. And then, so for most of the time, from the end of 1942 until the end of the summer of 1948, A.G. was reviewing for The Nation, too. So for 6 years, he was reviewing for two different places. And I went to look to see how many he wrote. And he reviewed over 700 movies at that time, 320 of which he did reviews for both magazines. So one thing that might be interested to people who would want to dip into this book is that to look at how he reviewed differently, the films differently for Time and The Nation. But that averaged out to about 137 reviews a year, or, you know, about 2.5 a week. So he was watching a lot of movies and doing a lot of writing. And, you know, I think anyway, it was really very, you know, really quite accomplished writing. You know, within a fairly short time of when he was writing for The Nation, The Nation got a letter to the editor from W.H. Auden, the British poet, who then was maybe one of the most famous British poets of the day. And it praised A.G.'s reviews for what he called its astonishing excellence, and said that, it was really kind of his high point in a certain way, and also calling it one of the, you know, really accomplished things in American journalism today. So from quite early on, A.G. was achieving something of a reputation of a film reviewer. But it was a very, very interesting time, I think. When he started reviewing, American movies were trying to figure out how they could contribute to the war effort. So remember, the U.S. entered after Pearl Harbor in December of 1941. So when A.G. just started reviewing, it was the first feature films like Casablanca and so on were coming out. And there also were a lot of documentaries that were being made about the war effort. And so one interesting thing for me was to look at those early years of his reviewing and see what he had to say about the documentary films.
Could he be critical at all of these documentary films about the war effort, given the seriousness of all of it?
Yeah, you know, I think he tended to be more critical, actually, about the fiction films about the war, which he tended to think were not so effective. Whereas if you look at the end of 1942 and 1943 and 1944, his sort of end-of-the-year summations of the best films of the year, he tended early on to say he thought the best films of the year were what he called the record films. That was a term that he used for documentaries. And as I was compiling these reviews, I was sort of interested to discover that many of those documentary films you can find on YouTube, like the National Archives, for example, makes them interesting. So it can be, for me, it was kind of interesting to look and see what he said about a particular film, and then go and look at that film and sort of respond to it myself. But he was 4F during the war. He was, you know, in his mid 30s and married and had a family by the time he started reviewing. But I think he actually felt that was a kind of a contribution to the war effort that he could make, was to write seriously about the films that he thought were pretty good. And I remember in several of the Nation reviews, he reflected about the difficulty of trying to render the genuine war experience for viewers who were not involved in the war. And talked about how some films seem to be better at doing that than others.
Did they have bylines back in those days? And if not, how did people know it was him writing? How can you get a reputation when you're not putting your name on it?
Yeah, well, Nation did. They did have a byline. So I think he became famous first for his Nation reviews. Time did not have bylines in those days. And that was actually one of the complicated things about trying to one thing that the book tries to do is to include every movie review and report and also cover story that A.G. did. And it was hard to pin that down. I had a bibliography to work with. But fairly early in the process, I ran across the name of a man named Bill Hooper, who was the chief archivist at Time magazine. And I actually sent him a list of all the films that had been attributed to A.G. In the best bibliography that I could find about A.G. And I sent him that list and asked him if it was accurate. And as it turned out, it wasn't fully accurate. About 13 of the reviews in Time that were attributed to A.G. and which were included in A.G. on Film, that book that came out in 1958, actually were written by someone else, I discovered. And then along the way, we also found a few things that hadn't been attributed to A.G. in the bibliographies that he did write. So that was fun. Apparently what Time did, after a volume was finished, someone in the copy desk would handwrite in who wrote each of the articles. And so Bill Hooper was nice enough to go through all those bound volumes for me. And so I think we have about as complete and accurate a list of A.G.'s Time reviews as we're ever able to get based on those bound volumes. But that was sort of fun for me. I like the detective work of doing research and so on. And this man was very generous with his time, and I owe him a bottle of wine and a lunch when I next get up to New York. So he was very, very helpful to me.
What are some of the distinguishing characteristics of his writing as a movie reviewer?
Different things. You know, he is such a good writer, you know, and the Nation reviews sometimes tended to be a little longer, and sometimes they tended to be a little bit more think pieces. So they had a certain kind of flavor to them. One thing, you know, I think one thing that distinguishes A.G.'s movie aesthetic is that he really believed in the possibility of a realist cinema. And so, I mean, if you think back about the descriptions that he had of the cabins that the sharecropper farmers lived in Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, he tended to admire films that would be very accurate and authentic and almost documentary in detail. One of the films that he really loved was a film by Georges Rouquier, a French filmmaker, who made a film called Farabique in 1947. It won an award at Cannes Film Festival. But his review of Farabique is very positive, and one thing he praises it for is its attention to the detail of 1 year in the life of this farm family, and there are scenes in there of them making bread and planting and harvesting and so on. And he really loved that authenticity, I think. So it isn't surprising that after the war, he really loved the Italian neorealist films. So if you look at his review of Shoeshine, for example, the Vittorio De Sica film, or Rome Open City, those are, you know, he was one of the first people really to praise and celebrate that national cinema movement. But A.G. could be very funny at times, and especially if a film he didn't like very well. And I plucked out a few of my favorites of those because In 1948, he started getting a little bit tired of reviewing, and he also was getting an aspiration to become a screenwriter, too. And he was getting, you know, some potential nibbles. And then his attention was getting diverted from movies a little bit. And then he had an appendectomy in the late winter, early spring of 1948, and he couldn't write for a couple of weeks. So if you go to the Nation magazine in the spring of 1940, he has a couple of columns where he reviews like about 25 movies, 30 movies, oftentimes in one sentence. So among the reviews he did at that time, one was a sort of a mystery film called The Unsuspected that he didn't like too much. So his total review of that was, "The Unsuspected, Warner Brothers, is suspected too soon by the audience and too late by most of his fellow actors." So that was one review.
That's the whole review?
That's the whole review, yeah. Another one, there's shorter ones too. I'm getting to that, okay, Todd. But there was another one, musical called Embraceable You, another Warner Brothers film, and his review of that, "Embraceable You is a dispensable entertainment." And then he has, this is sort of a topical reference, but there was a version of The Three Musketeers, and his review of that was, "The Three Musketeers has more ups and downs than the Berlin airlift." You know, they were shipping things back and forth to Berlin in the Cold War there. Then there was a John Wayne film called Tycoon. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It came out in 1948. But his review of Tycoon was, "Several tons of dynamite are set off in this movie. None of it under the right people." then there was a documentary film about French paratroopers. The title of it was made in France. It was called They Are Not Angels. And A.G.'s review was, "Well, who'd expect them to be? They're French parachute troops." And then the last one was a very sort of odd movie, sort of a melodrama, mystery, romance called You Were Meant for Me. And A.G.'s review was even shorter than the title of the film, "That's What You Think." So, I mean, one thing, if you have to think about it, if you were reviewing 700 films in 6 years, I actually think a movie reviewing job where you had to review everything that came out could easily become cumbersome and tiresome after a while, because you'd have to see a lot of stuff that wasn't so good. But A.G. sometimes had a lot of fun when he was even putting down a film that really wasn't very good. But another thing I found that really quite interesting that I didn't know about was that he wrote some long cover stories for Time magazine, and they're included in the volume. And so there's a long profile of Ingrid Bergman in it. There's a long profile of Gregory Peck, another one of the gossip columnists, Hedda Hopper, the actress Deborah Carr. So these were long essays that were researched by someone else at Time, and then A.G. wrote them. I think one that readers might especially find interesting is a long cover story on Laurence Olivier and his version of Shakespeare's Henry V. And it reads like, you know, a very learned essay by some kind of Shakespearean scholar, you know, that talks about the film, but then also talks about Olivier's career. And I also ran across when I was doing research for the book, there was UT Press and the University of Texas Press also have a lot of A.G.'s papers. Including, you know, different memoranda and different kinds of things that showed up in the papers that he saved. But see if I can find it here. There's his editor at Time was named T.S. Matthews, and I found a memo that Matthews wrote to all of the writers at Time, and this is what the memo said: "I want to call to your attention. I want to call your attention to the cover story on Ingrid Bergman in the current issue, August 2nd, 1943. I don't say it is a model story. It's only occasionally that we get a story that could or should be treated that way. But I do say it has one rare quality that makes it a standout. Aside from the qualities that are taken for granted in a good story, that it is clear without being flat, readable without being libelous, intelligent without being snobbish, critical without being cruel. Aside from these qualities that we take for granted, this story has a quality which we would like, which we would all like to see more of in humaneness. It is an appreciation of human beings at work, and God knows they need appreciation. The story was written, as probably you all know, by Jim Agee. He deserves a vote of thanks from all of us. Herewith he has mine. So that was interesting to run across that. And you might pair it with another comment that Matthews made. He, when A.G., there was a volume, a sort of tribute to A.G. that was made back in the 1950s after he passed away. Maybe came out in the early 60s. I can't remember exactly. But he wrote about A.G. as a reviewer. And in the essay, he said when he was editing at Time, Matthews learned to value, quote, the steady man, the slogger, the writer who got his copy in on time and did what he said he would. Without these writers, the magazine would never have made the weekly deadline. But then A.G. wasn't one of those, by the way. Matthews said he also appreciated the minority, never more than about three or four of every 50 writers, who were, quote, hard to work with, touchy, suspicious, arrogant, unpredictable. He included A.G. in that group, and he said A.G. had absolutely no feeling about going to press. And this group sometimes missed the target completely or failed to pull the trigger. But when they did make a hit, it was a bullseye. They were regarded by the rest of the staff with mingled contempt and awe. I, Matthews, loved and cherished them. So, you know, you see this respect that Matthews had for A.G. And it's really kind of fun to read those reviews alongside the Nation ones, because I think he had a much freer reign at the Nation. He had to kind of fit his writing into the Time style, so there's a different kind of flavor to them. And you know, one thing that that Time did was they would put cine something before for in the movie reviews, like cinemactor, an actor, a cinema actor, or cinemogul, you know, a movie mogul for cinema. So you see that sprinkled all the way through his Time reviews. He would never think of doing that, you know, for the Nation. But so, you know, to me, that was another very interesting thing about this process, was to try to bring together these reviews, some of which were done for a more intellectual audience, one that was maybe a little more inclined towards left political views. Time, I think, was a more conservative mass magazine and, you know, felt like they had to try to review all of the films. So A.G. had to live a kind of a dual life in some ways, writing for both of these different venues. So that was another fun thing in looking over these reviews during this process.
Now, he, as I understand it, he was not particularly vicious, despite the short little one-offs that you read, which were mildly vicious, but
yeah.
But is it true that he, if he didn't like a film, he wouldn't just totally destroy it?
Yeah, like a lot of good reviewers, I think he could find something good about certain movies, even if on the whole he thought it really wasn't a very good movie. So that was the case. He would give mixed reviews. One thing I've admired about A.G. is that I think he really loved the medium of movies, and I think he realized how hard it was to make a good movie, a really good movie. And I think he felt that the institution of Hollywood at that time actually made it hard for a filmmaker to be really inventive and do things too much out of the norm. But still, he really loved movies, and I think that's reflected in his review. So even when he would criticize a film, oftentimes he would say, well, maybe this performance was really quite striking, even though the script was a mess or something. And he did have a kind of a high standard. There were he had certain favorite filmmakers who he thought were really great from film history. One group of filmmakers he really admired were the silent film comedians: Chaplin, Keaton, Harold Lloyd, people like that. He also thought Griffith was D.W. Griffith was a really remarkable film director. Then there were a group of silent film directors from other countries: F.W. Murnau, the German expressionist; Sergei Eisenstein, the Russian filmmaker; Carl Dreyer, the Danish filmmaker, and a number of others. Hitchcock. He thought Hitchcock, both in the silent and in the sound period, was a really good filmmaker. So René Clair, a French filmmaker in early sound era, made these really wonderful comedies. A.G. just loved him, too. You'd sometimes see their names sprinkled through reviews of films that A.G. felt didn't live up to the standards of those filmmakers. But, you know, that's not to say he didn't like some contemporary American filmmakers. He liked, on the whole, Preston Sturges' movies, and Sturges is one of my favorites from that era. He makes these really literate, wonderful screwball comedies. A.G. thought he was really good. He liked Val Lewton, who was a producer of very low-budget films like The Curse of the Cat People and so on. But you see several reviews where he talks about how amazing it is that Lewton could make these striking films on this super low budget. Another American filmmaker he really loved was John Huston. And Huston, if you remember, went in to make documentary films during the war. He was the director of the Maltese Falcon before the war. But then during the war, he made several documentaries that A.G. was very much impressed with, like Pietro, about the Battle of San Pietro, two or three others. And then after the war, one of Huston's most important films right after the war was The Treasure of Sierra Madre with Humphrey Bogart. And A.G. wrote this just, you know, amazingly positive review about that. And it actually struck up a conversation, a male conversation between A.G. and Huston. Huston, after the Pietro review, wrote A.G. a thank you note. You know, he said, that's very rare when I see a critic who really got what I was trying to do that much. And it started that friendship that later ended up with Huston hiring him for The African Queen. And right after A.G. got done, he decided to make the jump into trying to do screenwriting in late 1948. He made a proposal to Life magazine, another Henry Luce publication, and he gave them about four or five ideas of articles that he could write for them. It was a way for him to make some money after he was off the Time payroll, but before he started making money in screenplays. And two of the proposals that Life accepted were an essay on silent film comedy, and that became the essay called Comedy's Greatest Era, which is, you know, I still think one of the greatest essays about the great American silent film comics: Chaplin, Keaton, Harold Lloyd, Mack Sennett, Harry Langdon. That was one essay that he wrote. That's included in the book. And then the second one is I think what you might call a very early example of auteur criticism. It's called Undirectable Director, and it's about John Huston. So, even as he was developing this relationship that led to his screenwriting work, he wrote this tribute to and celebration of John Huston's work. He had a really fascinating career as a writer about movies, I think.
Is there one review that you found or read that really enhanced a movie experience for you or made you either discover a new film or appreciate an older film in a new way?
I do have to say that that Comedy's Greatest Era, I was assigned that for a class back in college. And that did turn me toward those filmmakers and encouraged me to seek out those films. It's it's a really wonderfully written essay, and it's so clear from that essay how passionately A.G. loved those movies, and that sort of rubbed off on me. And in turn, whenever I would get an opportunity, now this was back even before VCR, so there was no home entertainment or anything like that. So I just had to, find some places that showed old movies and then be there on the night that they showed those movies. But that essay, I think, definitely had an influence on me, getting me interested in those. And as it turned out, I ended up including a chapter on Chaplin's movies in my dissertation, and then went on to write a book about Chaplin and American culture. So I guess maybe we can blame James A.G. partly for that.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting happenstance that you end up in Knoxville.
Yes.
You're from Minnesota, right?
I'm from Minnesota. Yeah. Listeners may still hear a little of that Scandinavian brogue whenever I go. I go back a couple times a year. My mother and two sisters still live in the Twin Cities area, so I go back to get my refresher course in my dialect. So that was one of the first things I did when I moved to Knoxville. I hadn't read A Death in the Family before, and I read and was very, moved by that book. And I had read some of A.G.'s movie criticism before that, but I took it as a real sort of privilege and honor in some ways to get a chance to participate in this complete work series. And I think as Knoxvillians, we all should thank Scott Danforth, who's the editor of the Press, and also Thomas Wells. He's been my editor on the project, and they're really committed to what I think is very, very important process of trying to get all of James Agee's works out in front of the public. And I can sort of understand why there hadn't been a complete edition before, because he's one of those writers who appeared after movies became an important part of popular culture. And unlike Henry James or Herman Melville, who all wrote pretty much in one genre or two genres, fiction and or poetry or both, A.G. wrote in so many different genres. He published volumes of poetry. He published novels. He published what I'd call social documentary, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, kind of creative nonfiction. He published screenplays. He published movie reviews. So it's very hard to put all of that into one box. But UT Press will be putting it into a row of books, that scholars in the future will be able to, study and explore and try to understand A.G.'s work. And so I do want to thank UT Press and also Hugh Davis and Mike LaFaro, who are the general editors. And they've done a lot of work over a lot of years to make this happen.
Yeah, it's really exciting.
Yeah,
that it's all coming out, and then it's going to have a home.
Yeah, yep.
Our guest again today on Changing Course, Chuck Malin. He's just completed an edition of James Agee's movie writing called Complete Film Criticism, Reviews, Essays, Manuscripts. Chuck, thanks for coming in.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.